Medicare is complicated. Medicare can be confusing. Medicare is no fun to study. Will you know what decisions to make when Medicare time arrives for you? My name is Doug Jones, and I wrote a book to help you figure it all out. Medicare for the Lazy Man. It's on sale at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Also, you can download and listen to my podcast, Medicare for the Lazy Man, wherever fine podcasts are given away free of charge. Medicare for the Lazy Man, simplest and easiest guide ever.
Par for the course, it's the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. The Medicare podcast that is 100% made in America. And now crapped out once again, Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. You might have heard my Canadian nephew, Drew McMillan, announce my arrival. It's Medicare expert of the day, Doug Jones, here to share a little Medicare sweetness and light with you. I'm always happy to talk about Medicare. I probably shouldn't call myself a Medicare expert. Witness a couple of episodes ago when I had to describe an oddball set of circumstances that even I, an expert, wasn't prepared for. So I should just call myself a Medicare specialist, because that's what I specialize in, helping people get through Medicare without problems, without trepidation and fear that some people have when they approach a government program and want to know how to deal with it and yet comply with all of the stupid regulations that the government has thrown in their way. That's what I specialize in doing. And how do I specialize in that? Well, I have written a book that should help guide you through the Medicare morass. The name of the book is Medicare for the Lazy Man 2023. And you can get that book for a very, very small amount of money if you go to BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com. And if you go to Amazon.com, you'll have your choice of four different types of editions. You can have the tried and true paperback, which is going to cost you about $8. You can have the second most popular, which is the Kindle or ebook or if you have an e-reader, Amazon can download the book to your device for less than $4. If you want to hear somebody else do all the work of reading and turning the pages and figuring out how to pronounce the very big, scary words that occur in Medicare sometimes, then you can buy the Audible book for a fairly reasonable amount. I think it's about $6. And you then finally have your choice of the hardcover book. Now, the hardcover book is kind of like the set of encyclopedias that you used to have on a shelf when you were a kid. It was a very complete but yet durable way to put out a book. The book has all of the knowledge that you're going to need for Medicare, as does all the other editions, or as do all the other editions, but it has colorful illustrations, which I think is going to brighten your day. Every time you turn a page, there's the possibility of having a new colorful edition in the hardcover book, and it makes a terrific gift for friends or loved ones that may be getting a little older in life and that may be approaching Medicare age, or may not be approaching Medicare age. That would certainly make a joke gift, a gag gift for the neighbors, friends, or relatives that you might be thinking about. So, Medicare for the Lazy Man 2023. And let's talk about a lazy man that I have in my podcast existence. That would be Randy Carson. If not lazy, sometimes sleepy. What would you say, Randy? Is that accurate? Or
I would prefer to say energy conservationist.
That's perfect. That is excellent. I'm going to use that the next time I'm accused of being too lazy.
So while you were bringing up various things in terms of topics leading into the podcast, reference information, you know, all the ways that they can get information about Medicare that you have provided. For some strange reason, a topic popped into my head, and I have a question for you.
Ask away,
when
Randy.
When you were a kid at home, did you have a set of encyclopedias?
We didn't really have a set of encyclopedias while I was a kid, and I can't explain why. Now, I went away to college, and when I came home, there was a magical set of encyclopedias there. You know what it was? We got a set of encyclopedias when I was younger, and it was like, first to eighth grade, but not high school or college. So yeah. I would say we didn't really have one of those massive, hugely expensive sets of encyclopedias.
Well,
but
we did.
And did you ever have to help your parents move them?
Well, that wasn't so much the issue. Let me describe. Now, you kids in the audience, and I'm saying kids because the people that are my age will remember this vividly. We were minding our own business out on the ranch one day.
Here came the salesman.
And here came the Encyclopedia Britannica salesman. Okay, well, my folks listened to his spiel, unfortunately, and didn't want to raise an idiot like me.
Yeah.
So they went ahead and purchased a set of Encyclopedia Britannica.
The words too late come to mind, but go ahead.
Yes. And I'm going to tell you my one big gripe about the Encyclopedia Britannica.
It wasn't written in American English. It was in British English.
Well, that was part of it. But when you went to the index, you know, I could hardly lift it, you know, as a kid.
Sure.
And you looked up some simple topic like horse, and there would be 45,000 sub-references that were scattered all over the various, encyclopedia books from, I think there was like 36 books. And all I wanted to know is a general idea about a horse. So in reality, as a kid in grade school.
Doing research.
I got very little good out of it because it was too much.
What if you went to H and just, you know, H-O? And
there
H-O-R.
Wasn't any. They weren't made, at least in my set of encyclopedias. There was no letter on it. You had to go to the index, I think. Now, people could, you know, write in and tell Doug whether I'm wrong because it was such a bad experience. I tried to wipe it from my mind because I thought I was really encyclopedia challenged.
I think memorizing the alphabet would have been your best friend there, unless the the books were not alphabetized. That would have been very difficult to deal with.
They were alphabetized, I believe, but there wasn't like an H on the spine of one of them.
Okay,
it was like,
that's
ridiculous.
Yeah,
general territory. I think they actually had, you know, it begins here and ends here kind of a thing.
Okay, so it'd be like a Roman numeral. This is volume 22. Yeah,
and 4012.
Oh, God. Well, here's my closest encyclopedia encounter. My parents had a, you know, we had a big spread in Wayne, Illinois, 4 acres and everything else. And my mother came down with polio in 1954 when I was a little kid. And so it hit her in one leg. And so she, that wrecked her tennis game and frankly caused her to have a nasty limp. And it was at some point when I was 11 years old, my parents decided that they wanted to sell our two-story house and build a one-story ranch house. And so in order to do that, they first sold our house and then they rented a house. And we crammed ourselves into a three-bedroom rental house. Everybody buddied up, you know, and it was... the house that we rented was in the village of Wayne, and it was a half of a barn. A big old barn had been cut in half, and half of it moved a block away, and they made it into two different houses. And so one day, for some reason, I decided to do a little exploring, and I went up into the attic, which had one of these pull-down stairways. So,
yeah.
And it had a lot of headroom. I mean, it was a very roomy attic. And they'd put down a plywood floor, so you weren't trying to walk from joist to joist and worried about falling through the plaster. But in this attic was an almost complete set of Applegate encyclopedias from 1898. And boy, wow. if you don't think the world was a more primitive place in 1898, I got news for you. And these books were outrageously ornate. The fonts were ornate. The covers were ornate. The spines had gold, embossed gold lettering on them and everything else. And most of the volumes were there. So I said to my parents, look what I found. And they said, oh, God, more garbage to have to deal with, you know, because half our stuff was in storage anyway. For 2 years, it took them to build the other house, the new house. And so we had those encyclopedias, and I used to look up things just to see what was different. And one of my favorite things was to look up Africa. I had an easier time finding a subject than you did. But in Africa, back in the 1800s, Africa was a totally different place than it is today. And that's because all these countries have their independence now. But back then, there was a big area in the middle of Africa that nobody knew anything about. You know, darkest Africa. And then there were the German colonies and the English colonies, and other countries had colonies, Portuguese and so forth. And there was a whole lot of stuff in that set of encyclopedias that was different than there is today. So then I had an estate sale after my parents died, and somebody swooped them all up.
So now they're sitting in some ornate antique library.
I couldn't tell you.
Some kid like you? Still looking at Africa.
Maybe. I was also looking up naked ladies to see what I could learn about human reproduction and all that.
I learned all that from the Sears and Roebuck catalog.
Yeah, that was I learned about undergarments, you know, foundation garments from Sears catalog.
What kid didn't?
Yeah. Yep. Well, anyway, I think it's time to get going here because we have enjoyed ourselves far too much. So I'm going to kick Randy out of the studio and take off with one of our planned subjects for today. And I think the one I'm going to choose is pancreatic cancer. The reason it's on my mind is that I remember years ago when my father was still alive, and he was hale and hearty until the day he dropped dead in the yard with a rake in his hand. But he always would tell his friends, the only reason I subscribe to the local newspaper is because I want to read the obituaries. And back when I was much younger, I thought that was kind of silly, but I have grown into my father now, and that's the first thing I look at when I see a local newspaper. But many people, when Mary and I watch TV shows, especially shows from the 1950s or 60s, and we recognize faces and we have to figure out who these stars are. And when I Google them, you know, a tool that didn't exist when I was a kid, or when I look them up in Wikipedia, I find that a shocking number of them have died from pancreatic cancer. So over the years, every time I hear about somebody that's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I came to realize that it's a death sentence. Now, the latest victim of pancreatic cancer seems to be Jerry Springer. He died recently, and the news organizations don't ever tell you why somebody died for the most part. But Jerry Springer was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer at some point in his fairly recent past. Who else might have died, you know, in the fairly recent past? Well, Alex Trebek, a lot of talk about him. I think he announced his diagnosis about a year before his death. And then you got your Ruth Bader Ginsburg and probably a whole lot of other people. So I ran across an article that purports to be a representation of progress in the war on pancreatic cancer. And I thought, boy, you know, that's actually something that's kind of uplifting and hopeful, that perhaps we will have a way to beat this scourge, and I'm all for it. So then I just pulled out a few reference points here to talk to you about. First of all, the article I'm looking at right now is Why is Pancreatic Cancer So Deadly? It talks about Alex Trebek after he announced that he had been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. The cause of his death was not immediately announced, but it was eventually disclosed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I mentioned. This year, an estimated 56,770 new cases of pancreatic cancer will be diagnosed, and an estimated 45,750 of those are going to die. About 95% of the people with pancreatic cancer die from it. It's so lethal because during the early stages, when the tumor would be most treatable, there are usually no symptoms. It tends to be discovered in advanced stages when abdominal pain or jaundice may result. Presently, there are no general screening tools. As people age, the risk of developing pancreatic cancer goes up. That's not good news for Randy and me, I'll tell you right now. Most patients are older than 45, and nearly 90% of the patients are older than 55. The average age at diagnosis is 71. Men have a slightly higher likelihood of, Randy's telling me, are you 71, Randy? God, right on the money. Okay.
I'm going to be 71 here in about 20 minutes, Doug.
Yeah, well, you better get your ass to the doctor then, because I want to make sure that this is not something that hits you. I can't imagine doing this podcast with anybody else, so don't even ask me to think about it. Let's see here. The average age at diagnosis is 71, which Randy will be in about 20 minutes. Men have a slightly higher likelihood of developing pancreatic cancer than women do, which may partly result from increased tobacco use. And Randy and I are both we're not ex-smokers. We've ceased. We've temporarily stopped smoking.
We are not smoking. I'm still a smoker. I am not smoking. Yeah.
I am a smoker too, and I stopped about 8 years ago. I have one cigarette per year, but yes, we have paused in our smoking enjoyment. Currently, the lifetime risk of developing pancreatic cancer. The lifetime risk of developing it is about 1 in 63 for men and 1 in 65 for women. So if you've got a party going on, let's say you invite everybody you know and you got 65 people in your house, one of those people is going to get pancreatic cancer. And if it's not one of your guests, it's you.
I was going to say there's a dead man walking.
Yeah, somebody's in there. And that would be, I don't know what I'm laughing about. This is not a pleasant subject.
Just hope it's your neighbor.
Well, there you go. Oh, here's some bad news for some and better news for others. There is also a noted association with race. Blacks are more likely to develop it than whites. Although all the victims I read about in the news and all the TV stars and everything are all white. The ones I see that have pancreatic cancer, a girl from my high school class, and she's a wonderful woman, but she has been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I don't know. I think I heard about it a couple of years ago. I'm hoping that she continues to do well. Doctors don't know why, but speculate that the higher rates of men smoking and having diabetes and women being overweight may contribute to that association with blacks having more pancreatic cancer. So what are the types of pancreatic cancer? Apparently there are several types. I'll skip over that. Treatment options. It's usually controllable only through removal by surgery and only if found before it has spread. Palliative care can help if a patient's quality of life, if the disease has spread, can help with the patient's quality of life if the disease has spread. Two drugs approved in 2011 may help patients with pancreatic neuroendocrine and, yada, yada, yada. Now we get into the medical minutiae. So let's see. Do transplants help? Because it is so rare, there isn't a lot of evidence to support the transplant as a cure. The procedure could extend life, but immunosuppression drugs may allow any remaining cancer to grow faster. And European studies have found that the majority of patients who underwent liver transplant of this type of tumor had a recurrence of the disease. But many pancreatic cancers are detected in later stages because the tumor is small and it often does not produce any symptoms. As they grow, these adenocarcinomas can obstruct the ducts from the liver and cause severe back pain. These tumors sometimes produce insulin, so a patient's first symptoms could be low glucose levels. But most tumors do not produce hormones. So let's see here. The future of treatment researchers are working on better understanding the way in which pancreatic tumors grow and spread. Now, that is one article down the chute. And the reason that we're talking about pancreatic cancer is that there is good news. A small-scale trial saw an immune response provoked in half of the patients treated, with those people showing no relapse of their cancer during the study, something outside experts call extremely promising. It's their articles that I, in publications I don't subscribe to because I don't want to give them any money, but in the New York Times headline is pancreatic cancer vaccine shows promise in small trial. And CNN says an mRNA vaccine that programs the body to fight pancreatic cancer shows early promise. Well, I just happen to have that article here. I got it for free. So let's delve into that. Barbara Bingham was, Brigham, like in Brigham and Women's Hospital. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in September of 2020. The odds were not in her favor. It's one of the most legal malignancies, fatal in 88% of the patients. It's also one of the hardest to treat. Tumors can be surgically removed, but the tumors come back within 7 to 9 months in 90% of the patients. Chemotherapy can help prolong life, but it too is rarely a cure. Radiation, immunotherapy, and targeted therapies also don't work. Today, nearly 3 years after her diagnosis, Brigham says regular scans find no trace of the cancer in her pancreas. She credits an experimental therapy, a personalized cancer vaccine, and she was one of 16 patients in this test. 16, eight patients had an excellent result from the use of the therapy. The other eight patients had no positive effect from the therapy. However, two of those eight have had no recurrence of the cancer. So I don't know what that says, but anyway, they've moved it from like 90% fatal to 50% fatal so far, if this test is indicative of a successful therapy. And so what is the test? Well, basically it's training the body's T cells to fight the cancer, the specific cancer in the pancreas. And in order to do this test, they had to take diagnostic samples of tissue or whatever, send them to France or Germany or someplace, and then create the vaccine, send it back to the United States, and it was given to all of these people. In blood tests, all eight responders made T cells against their tumors, and those have persisted for at least 2 years despite a follow-up course of chemotherapy. Among eight patients who did not respond adequately to the vaccine, just two have not seen their cancer return. So that tells them that this is a very effective vaccine against pancreatic cancer. I think it's really promising. It highlights the mRNA platform and the versatility to be able to personalize or tailor these vaccines to each patient's specific tumor and generate these customized vaccines in a fairly short amount of time. It remains to be seen, but certainly very exciting preliminary results. The study wasn't designed to test whether the vaccines would be effective. Researchers set out to see whether the therapy would be safe and even feasible. They also wanted to see if the three-stage regimen they were testing would create the desired immune responses. The researchers were looking for any correlation between whether the vaccine worked and whether it created a clinical benefit. Sometimes drugs do what they're supposed to do, but for whatever reason, they don't treat the disease. I don't know what that means. I think it's definitely very encouraging to see that an immune response correlates with the recurrence-free survivor or survival. However, it's a small study with only 16 patients in phase one. So it's a correlation, not a causation. We do have to test causation in a larger clinical trial. For this first study, doctors surgically removed the patient's tumors and sent the tissue to a lab in Germany where scientists sequenced genetic code from the tumors. and from the patient's blood. They compared those sets of genes to find the ones that were allowed in the cancer cell or altered in the cancer cells. After they identified the changed genes, they ran them through a computer program to let it pick the ones that would make the most effective targets. Then they made their personalized mRNA vaccines. Patients got 8 doses, which were infused into their bloodstream rather than injected into their muscles. That's because researchers were trying to stimulate a slightly different part of the immune system. The type of immune response you want to elicit is slightly different from the type of immune response you want to elicit against a virus, whether it's an antibody or blah, da, 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 da. Blood circulation through the lymph system, where lymph nodes and lymph organs like the spleen help make T tests. There was a portion of this article that said that one of the reasons that this couldn't be used on your traditional post-operative pancreatic cancer victims was that they would take the tumors out and they would take the spleen out. And I think this course of treatment requires that the spleen be intact in order for it to be successful. I think somehow I overlooked that part of the article, but I remember reading it earlier when I was doing show prep for this particular podcast episode. So let's see. Oh yeah. Well, here we go. I shouldn't have been so hasty. There are 2 main types of pancreatic cancer surgery. One involves removal of the spleen along with the tumor. It turns out that the vaccine concentrates in the spleen, which seems to be important in developing that large pool of tumor-attacking T cells. When researchers give the vaccine to mice that had their spleens removed, they didn't respond as well as the ones that had their spleens intact. Ah, thank you, mice. 7 of the study participants had had their spleens removed, and 5 of them were in a group that did not respond well to the vaccine. He notes that the guy that's being interviewed notes that in the small study, differences were not statistically significant, but might be in a larger trial. So that's our current working hypothesis, he said. The lady that we heard interviewed, Brigham, said she is just thankful that she could participate. I'm just grateful to have been allowed to fake it. No, to take it, the 77-year-old says. She was recently able to watch her oldest grandchild graduate from college, a moment she didn't think she'd live to see. The opportunity and timing was so perfect, it helped me, and I hope it helps someone else. Well, that would be a fantastic step forward in the battle against cancer if an effective way to squelch pancreatic cancer were devised. And I like the fact that they're using this specialized technology that creates the vaccine that's designed to work in your body as opposed to somebody else's. I think that's the promise of genetic research that we've all been hearing about all these years, along with our flying cars, which we still don't have. So at least we may have the no flying cars. No, Randy doesn't have one.
Flying cars. We aren't to the Jetsons yet.
Not yet, but we're sneaking up on it with this type of cancer therapy working out.
We are. I must say that is good news because I know some people along the way that pancreatic cancer has taken very quickly. I mean, literally, I had a boss that I really respected and enjoyed working with. One day they came in and said, you know, Ken's got pancreatic cancer. And the next Monday, Ken's gone.
Yeah. And it's like 88 or 90% of the people who have the diagnosis are unable to survive.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, that is good news. And I certainly hope that someone could pull it out of the bag and get some vaccine going.
Well, they're working on it. It's just not as simple as we'd like to think sitting around our house. I remember when I was a kid, they have a vaccine against polio. Well, that's pretty cool. And pretty soon, nobody ever got polio anymore. It sounds easier than it really is in real life. I mean, there must be thousands of people working on figuring out how to do this. Oops, pardon me while I watch one of my comely neighbors walk by, walking her dog. I had the garage door open one day when she walked by, and she gave my classic cars a hairy eyeball. And I thought,
cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you like Bear Can Blue, lady?
I'm not going to ask her that because I'm a married man. So we're just going to stay away from that subject for the time being.
Okay,
anyway,
so anyway,
I think we should turn the audience loose for the day.
Yeah, we've definitely spent our 75 cents, but it was a really worthwhile 75 cents because I certainly enjoyed it. I learned something, as I do every time. However, Doug won't let me spend any more money, so I need to pull in the reins on this stagecoach. We are going to stop it right here and cover some information that I always like to cover at the end. In case you hadn't learned this fact, Doug is a nationwide licensed agent to help you with your Medicare supplemental plans and drug plans, actually, too. You can contact him, get a pencil, dbj@mlmmailbag.com. You can check us out at medicareforthelazyman.com, our website, or Doug already talked about the ways to get the Kindle, the paperback, and all those different versions of his book, Medicare for the Lazy Man 2023. And if you could find a place to give us a rating on the podcast and the book, we'd certainly appreciate it. We're always up against it in terms of ratings. That's just the business we're in. But if you can do that, it would make our life a lot easier and put a smile on Doug's face. So today, if you weren't counting, you have spent about 32 and a half minutes with Doug Jones, the anti-insurance insurance guy, originally from Oklahoma, no more, living up in the high altitudes behind Cave Creek, Arizona, in his fortress of solitude. And today I checked the altitude before we got on the air, and I'm going to put it in at about 5,000 feet.
That's reasonable. I'm so happy you did that. Thank you, Randy. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today. We'll look forward to talking to you next time.